Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd, and this is the Chuck Toddcast. The restrictive Texas abortion law has done more than just limit access to abortion and introduce a new concept of bounty hunter laws. It has reset the debate, perhaps ahead of the 2022 midterms. A little more than a year to go, the terms of the campaign are clearly still in flux, where Republicans could once focus almost exclusively on President Biden, tag him with every piece of bad news. Democrats may have their own motivating issue to get some voters to the polls. So joining me today, Kristen Soltis Anderson, a Republican pollster and co-founder of Echelon Insights, and Cornell Belcher, a Democratic pollster and president of Brilliant Corners Research and Strategies. Kristen and Cornell, welcome back to the Toddcast. And look, with abortion, I wanted to be here with two pollsters. You know, you guys have to pragmatically figure out where meet voters where they are. And then I guess that's the first place to start on this issue, which is, I'm going to ask you first, Kristen, do you feel like this is an issue that potentially resets the thinking on the midterms?
I don't think so. And in part because I recall 8 years ago in 2013, summer of 2013, you had another controversial Texas abortion law. And a woman named Wendy Davis, who was in the Texas legislature, stood on the floor of the Texas state capitol. She filibustered the bill. She came to national acclaim, magazine covers. You know, she did it in her pink tennis shoes. And everybody said, this is going to be, you know, a seminal moment in this debate nationally. And the subsequent midterm, Republicans did quite well in 2014, and Wendy Davis never won another election in Texas again. So I that is, to me, instructive for why we should be cautious about assuming that what is happening now in September of 2021 will have a dramatic effect, given that there's the potential of so many other things occurring between now and then. Now, this could change if the Supreme Court, for instance, when it takes up its next case that will more directly evaluate whether the precedent set in Roe and then upheld in Casey versus Planned Parenthood will stay in effect or will be modified. The law in Mississippi, which would set the line at 15 weeks for when the cutoff is for abortion, if the Supreme Court says, look, we're going to change the standard from viability to say that a state can set the line at 15 weeks if they'd like, that would be, I think, a bigger deal and the sort of thing that could continue to have resonance through the next year. But I think at the moment, I am skeptical barring any further action that this winds up affecting the midterms.
Cornell, do you share that or are you in a different spot?
I can't argue with the logic there. The question becomes, what's different now that would change the dynamics? I think the dynamics here are different than they were going in into the last time around. Look, I think there is a sense that you know, women's rights are more under siege now than they were then, and I think this is just a, you know, one more piece of fire one more piece of wood on the fire here, that women feel their rights are being under siege and feel, look, I mean, the whole Trump era, you know, you saw women becoming more active, because they feeling sort of their rights and sort of under siege, and they feel disrespected by what they saw in the Trump era, and they came out and they changed the face of the 2018 midterm election in a way that was very unusual. Are we going to have the same sort of thing here? I think there's potential here if, in fact, women do feel as though their right to choice could possibly go away, and I think that's a big if. I think if you look back historically, Democrats have had a hard time rallying women voters around choice, simply because most women don't think about it, sort of thinking it's going to go away.
Republicans, they don't believe it's going to go away. They don't believe it's in threat.
Right.
That's always been the point. Yeah.
And Chuck, the moment that middle American women think that this is actually something that they're going to lose, I think Democrats have a way to energize them and mobilize them for the election, in a way that we have not before. Republicans have been doing it for years, mobilizing their votes around around abortion, around sort of, you know, anti-abortion. I think this potentially could give Democrats that opening, if the big if they fear it's going to go away.
Well, Jack, let me actually throw in there not a counter argument, but sort of an alternate theory of, if the Supreme Court winds up striking down the Mississippi law or striking down the Texas law if it comes back, you know, on the merits of the constitutionality of the abortion provisions. If the Supreme Court winds up saying, no, we're upholding Casey, we're upholding Roe, you can also imagine a world where there are some conservative voters who
goes the other way.
They go the other way and they say, are you saying that we have elected Republican senators, Republican president in Donald Trump to put these folks on the bench? This is our number one priority. And if it doesn't happen now, it's never going to happen. So there is a potential for this to disillusion and disappoint some conservative base voters if the court doesn't go the other way. And then the question is, well, what's, you know, politically, what's the trade-off there? Does upholding the precedent, does it wind up, you know, then taking it off the table, but also depressing some of the conservative base? That's the other way this could go.
Well, let me ask, and if I was about to follow up with you, Kristen, but I'm going to put this to both of you. And so, Cornell, you start first, which is, do you think it does matter? You know, it's interesting how you said how, I think, I you don't ever want to predict what a Supreme Court's going to do. I think it's pretty clear the Mississippi law is going to get, going to be allowed. The question is, how are they going to allow the Mississippi law? Are they going to do it through upholding Roe and basically just saying, hey, as you noted, Kristen, that just a redefinition of viability, let the states, or is it an actual overturn of the law? Does that technicality, eroding Roe versus overturning Roe, matter in how much of an intensity on the issue it will be in 22? Cornell, you first.
I think it does, but it's not, you know, the process is one thing. It is how you message it. It is, can Democrats message the erosion of Roe in a way that puts fear in the hearts of women and progressive voters? If they can, I think it is a unique mobilizing opportunity. If they cannot, I think again, it's women aren't afraid of their reproductive rights going away. So I think it's really about sort of how Democrats are able to frame it. And right now, Chuck, I don't know, because we don't know sort of what the outcome's going to be. And certainly, so we haven't been sort of testing it or unpacking sort of message frames around it. So there's a big question mark there.
Kristen, you seem to think that that voters will see a distinction between an overturn of Roe and an erosion?
Well, not necessarily, in part because, you know, what the Supreme Court did over the last week was not an overturn of Roe, and yet it was messaged that way entirely. That's what the debate has been about. It was not about tricky legal questions of who has standing and who doesn't. It was about, this is an attack on Roe. So I don't know that necessarily the way this gets covered or the way most voters perceive it will have that particular nuance. But we do know that the polling suggests there is a difference between American voters' appetite for, say, a complete ban on abortion or a ban on abortion at, you know, at the heartbeat, 6 to 8 weeks. You know, Gallup has found that that is something that 58% of Americans oppose. But the later you go into pregnancy, the more and more comfort there is for voters with saying, I'm okay with drawing the line here. I'm okay with beginning restrictions at this point. 15 weeks is not the same as 6 weeks, and it's not the same as a complete ban. So while I don't know that many voters will really process it in that way, I do think there is a distinction in the polling between a complete ban of abortion or the elimination of Roe v. Wade. And when you actually ask people, how do you feel about, say, preventing abortions in the second trimester?
I don't disagree with that. But it is an earlier point. It is, that's a process, right? And I think intellectually that's spot on. But I think in the end, It is not a process argument. Is this eroding your reproductive rights? Are they coming for your reproductive rights? And sort of in the back and forth of a campaign, it is, are they coming for your reproductive rights? And do you feel as though they're coming for your reproductive rights? And so I think it's less about the process and more about, can they, can progressives light a fire again under women, like we saw we were able to do in 2018, light a fire under women in a unique way, given this issue? And I think that's still a big question mark, depending on what the court does.
Is the let's break this down a little bit by state and the Senate maps, because the Senate maps and the presidential battleground basically are the same. I mean, it's an incredible 22 cycle when you look at the Senate seats that are up. It basically, it's a, either you can call it a continuation of 2020 or a preview of 2024, or essentially just the never ending nonstop season that I equate to like European soccer. European soccer is always in season. I just never know what season they're in. So that was a weird aside there. My apologies. So let me ask you this, Kristen, Florida and Texas, if Florida does a copycat law, is DeSantis pushing the envelope? Because when you look at abortion messaging, where the Republican primary voters are and where the rest of the country are, couldn't be further apart.
So I think it's really interesting to watch the way many Republican politicians who have any kind of national ambitions have been dealing with this issue. On Sunday, I took a look at Senator Ted Cruz's website and Twitter feed, and there was not a mention of the Texas law. I saw a clip of DeSantis being asked, you know, what do you think about it? And it was a kind of equivocal, like, we're going to have to take a look. We'll see. It was not sort of a full-throated endorsement. So I think a lot of these folks understand that on the one hand, this is potentially a big victory for the pro-life cause, if to the extent that the law stays in place, but at the same time, at what cost politically? So I just think it's instructive that someone like DeSantis or someone like Ted Cruz did not come out last week with a sort of vocal, you know, pounding the table, yes, this is great sort of position, and is playing a little bit more wait and see.
I think we're still waiting for John Cornyn's reaction, aren't we? By the way, John Cornyn, I feel like, has been very, said very little. So, Cornell, do you think this changes the calculus in Texas and Florida in the midterms?
Again, it's hard to say, because I think there's still some dynamics unfolding. But I do think it is very instructive that Republicans are not out trumpeting this broadly, and they don't really want to sort of talk a lot about this. I think that's very strategic, because quite frankly, again, I do think that if we go into a midterm election, And this is nationalized around whether you want to sort of keep Roe or you want to throw out Roe, I kind of like Democrats' chances to change the dynamics of what's typically a midterm election favoring Republicans. And I think Republicans get that. So I think the downplaying of it is smart, but at the same time, you sort of mobilize and energize your base around it, which is an entirely different conversation, because Republicans are doing a very good job of mobilizing, energizing, and then mobilizing their base. I mean, Bannon is out mobilizing, the base right now and the grassroots level in local and state elections, and Democrats aren't. And I'm really worried about, you know, looking at both of those states. What I'm most worried about is whether or not the base of Democrats are as energized as the base of Republicans are, and have Democrats given them anything? Have we thrown them any red meat? Have we fed the fire at all the way Republicans have? And I don't think we have.
I'm going to pause right there. We'll be right back after a quick break. You're listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Kristen, what should we take from Terry McAuliffe's quick pivot to abortion in Virginia? And I say it because, is it a sign of strength or a sign of weakness or both?
I think it's a sign that there may be worries that the Democratic base is just not as motivated as they were during the Trump era. You know, when Donald Trump was president, Democrats were fired up. He was the big boss that, you know, every election was about a statement about Donald Trump. And now that he is, you know, down at Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster, wherever he is, you know, occasionally putting out a press release that winds up kind of becoming a tweet, doing rallies here and there, you know, is he less of the big boss that motivates Democrat base voters to turn out? So you need, if you're Terry McAuliffe, you're in a state that is D plus, I don't know what the exact number is, but the advantage is on your side, but the biggest problem you could face is if your base doesn't show up, but a Republican base very eager to sort of turn the tables and fight back against Democrats taking control of everything at the federal level, do show up, do vote for someone like Glenn Youngkin. I mean, especially since Youngkin, I think, has been pretty savvy at walking that line between having been supportive enough of Trump in the primary to get through there, but sort of having pivoted to more of a trying to make that pivot to more of a mainstream approach during the general by sort of forcing the issue on something like abortion, where I would assume a majority of Virginia voters are lean more pro-choice, and again, particularly those the Democratic base. You need to get them fired up in a year when, say, Joe Biden's job approval rating is continuing to tick down, and you may have real concerns about enthusiasm on the Democratic side.
You know, it's interesting to me, to stick with Virginia here a minute, Cornell. It feel like the political climate for Terry McAuliffe right now looks awfully similar to the climate he was in the first time he ran in 2013. You know, now it was a second term bit of a hangover for President Obama at the time. You had all sorts of, you know, we had sort of congressional showdowns over fiscal. I think there was another debt ceiling fight. And then, of course, in the middle of October, I think of 13 is when the website failed. So you had both a government shutdown and the failure of a website. It just sort of demoralized the Democratic base, and he almost lost. What does he need from September with Biden and Democrats to make sure he doesn't sort of face that similar? I mean, put it this way. Had Glenn Youngkin been his opponent in 2013 instead of Ken Cuccinelli, he would have lost, is probably the point I'd make there. So what does McAuliffe need from Democrats and Biden in the next 30 days?
Well, first, I have to laugh at, because quite frankly, I live in D.C., so I get all the Northern Virginia ads that they're running. And from the advertiser, I wouldn't know it was a Republican running to be governor of Virginia.
Well, not Northern Virginia. Yeah, he doesn't identify himself as a Republican.
Right. I think that's one smart thing that makes this very different. But look, I think the dynamics of this coming cycle looks an awful lot like sort of the dynamics we saw going into 2010. And my fear is that a lot of Democrats and progressives have very little contextual understanding or forget history, because the dynamics are shaping up very similar. Look, if you really want to nerd out and get into the numbers, when I ran the voter file data from the 2010 across the battlegrounds, what you have, Chuck, is you have 65 plus performing Republican precincts turning out at 16 points higher than 65 plus Democratic performing precincts. In most places, unless you have huge Democratic
this was advantages, in 2010. Yeah.
The advantages, that means you're losing. That's a problem with these off-year elections, is that it's not voters changing their minds, they're different electorates. And I think what Democrats are faced with right now is the exact same thing they were faced with 2010, and that is those 65 plus performing Democrat precincts are not energized. And if we see them turning out at 16 points lower than Republican precincts, Terry's in trouble, and certainly House Democrats and Senate Democrats are in for a shellacking. And so what I think Democrats need to do is take a page from Republicans' page book, right? It's not a bad thing to actually, throw red meat and energize our base voters. And they're not getting anything right now from National Democrats in the way of sort of just red meat politics.
Yeah, I hear you. But the problem is the tanking in the polls is not the base. It's independents, right? Well, like, that's the conundrum that Democrats are facing. Their base is frustrated, but it's independents who are punishing the party right now.
Yeah, but look at the party barometers. I mean, they're not, the independents aren't in love with Republicans, right? And if you look
they're not happy with their, right. No, it's a turd sandwich and a shit burger. You know, you pick it, right?
Right.
You know, in their mind.
And to go one step further, it is, and what, from a policy standpoint, are Republicans offering up right now that independent voters go, yeah, overwhelmingly independent voters are for those things. So, yeah, I hear you on both sides, but we got to give, but Republicans, it's mm-hmm. about energizing your base. It really is, right? And persuading independents. But if your base is not energized, Republicans get this. If your base is not energized, Chuck, in a midterm, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Chuck, one other thing that I think is important to point out about the Virginia race is another issue that's going to be a big deal is questions of schools, whether they're reopening, what the curriculum looks like. These are all things that Youngkin has talked a lot about and has sort of felt like are issues that are on his side. And you've got places like Loudoun County, you know, that used to be, you know, upscale kind of Republican exurb type place that wound up swinging to become a 20-point advantage for Democrats in the Northam Gillespie race in 2017. And yet it's also the place now where you have parents kind of up in arms about, why were my schools not open? What are you teaching my kids, et cetera. These are the sorts of issues that Republicans think are going to be able to make independents wary enough of Democrats that they might be more open to coming over to the GOP side.
Kristen, I think there's less and less to glean from these off years, especially as Virginia becomes less competitive, or at least less like other swing states. You know, it was in swing state. It was in our purple state category for about a day. But what are you going to, it feels like anything like McAuliffe winning by three or less or losing, there's still potentially things to learn in a positive way for the GOP. What are those things in your mind?
Well, Republicans need to do better in the suburbs. And, you know, no matter how these new districts get chopped up for the House for 2022. We know from the census from this year that there has been enormous growth in denser parts of America. And so Republicans have to learn, and that's a story of Virginia as well, that the growth of suburbs around both Richmond and Washington, D.C. has been a huge factor in Virginia's political evolution. So if Republicans can win statewide, I think if Youngkin is able to do better and run up good margins with people in the suburbs, after having survived a Republican primary, which granted was very bizarre, strangely structured, but was against, you know, people who fashioned themselves as mini Trumps, you know, throughout the process, he may show that it is possible to, in a blue state, walk that line, survive a primary, put together a coalition. I think that will gain a ton of attention from national Republicans as they try to figure out what's the sort of post-Trump, if we are actually in a post-Trump Republican Party moment, which I think is very debatable. But if that's where we're at, what does that look like? This will become a lesson if Youngkin is able to do what I just described, which
right,
is a big if.
I was just going to say, but Cornell, a Youngkin loss, why do I feel like in the binary world of Republican politics where nuance is not allowed, it'll be just seen as, oh, this is what happens when you keep the president at arm's length.
Because Trump is going to scream that.
I mean, I know that there's no like statistical logic to back up what I just said, right? It's actually, no, if you embrace Trump, you know, it would guarantee a loss, right? But maybe the fifth district would have a higher, he performs a little bit higher in the fifth congressional district, or the sixth, excuse me, the sixth actually now, I think would be the one. But that could be it. What I'm wondering is there a perverse, if Youngkin loses, does that mean that nobody can distance himself from Trump? You're just not allowed.
Well, I think it's tough. If you're a Republican, it's tough distancing yourself from Trump right now because the heart and soul of the core of the movement, the energy right now is with Trump and his supporters. And I would argue it was a Republican primary in Virginia, a real primary. I think it's tough not to be where it's tough for you not to put your arms around Trump right now if you're a Republican because the base will punish you. However, at the same time, in states like Virginia, if you are embracing Trump, and again, I don't know that he is even a Republican from his advertising. If you embrace right. Trump, it absolutely puts you at a disadvantage increasingly into the point that Christine made is sort of those suburban voters. We've seen the suburbs flip, right? We've seen the suburbs flip in a lot of the battleground states where they were once fairly consistently leaning Republican, from Pennsylvania to, you know, Wisconsin to Virginia and keep your eye on North Carolina. They are now sort of more competitive and leaning Democrat. If you embrace Trump, you're wedging yourself from a lot of those upscale, better educated white voters.
Right. Now, the reverse, Kristen, is if he pulls off, if Youngkin pulls this off, he just provided the blueprint of how to sort of Heisman Trump without giving him the middle finger.
Exactly. I mean, the core challenge Republicans are going to face in the midterms, from my perspective, is they've got the wind at their backs, right? They've got history on their side. It's a midterm. They're out of power. Redistricting, reapportionment, all the stuff should be helping them. But Trump is the big X factor because it is without a doubt that Donald Trump brought new people into the Republican coalition, even as the coalition also shed some voters. That's why, even though turnout was sky high in the last presidential election, a lot of those new voters were Trump voters. Not enough of them, but a lot of them were. So the party has to figure out how can you keep those new folks Trump added in the coalition, but avoid the negative side effects of Trump. Because Democrats have benefited from Trump energizing their base without having to face the downsides of any downsides of Trump in terms of energizing Republicans in the 2018 midterms. What happens in a reverse environment then? Can the Trump coalition hold together when Trump's not on the ballot? I still think that's a big question and I don't even know if Virginia will give us a clear answer on that.
All right, Cornell, have Democrats already lost the battle to frame the big budget deal beyond a number? I feel like the only thing everybody knows about the $3.5 trillion package is that it's a $3.5 trillion package.
Well, they're not winning it. But can that change? But you're absolutely right. It is how do we unpack this budget and all the things that are in this budget, by the way, that we know from polling voters really want and voters like. I mean, voters really want infrastructure.
Yeah. I've seen that movie, the healthcare bill. It's really popular.
Right.
The individual part.
Yeah, right. But we fail to sell it. Look, I think it's fair to say that I would argue that the Democrats are really good at governing and legislating, and really bad at messaging and politics. And Republicans are really bad, if you ask me, at governing and legislating, but really good at the politics point. Right now, Chuck, I think you're right. We're losing. And I think we got to change that dynamic or this does become 2010 again. But before I go, I will like to point out how hysterical it is to me that Trump is still the one of the largest figures going into yet another election, and he's not even president anymore.
No, that is remarkable. But everything Trump has done has been, frankly, counterintuitive to what everything else we had learned about American politics in all of our decades of doing this. Anyway, Cornell, Kristen, appreciate both of you navigating us through. One little prediction that I have, and I'm curious if you both have it. I think we're going to see another high turnout midterm, which of course isn't an automatic benefit to either side. Cornell, where are you at this?
I hope you're right, because I actually do think it's a benefit to Democrats, because I think if you see a high turnout, it means younger voters, millennials are turning out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it just depends on the state. That's why. I mean, I think a high turnout. We saw a high turnout in Florida is an automatic for Democrats. That's for sure. Kristen, where's your head?
I think it's going to be a lower turnout. I mean, look, once somebody votes for the first time, they're likely to keep voting. We had so many new people enter the process in 2020 that a lot of them will stick around. They've been converted from non-voters to voters. But without Donald Trump on the ballot, you lose a strong animating force for both Republicans and Democrats. So that's why it wouldn't surprise me if it's a little bit lower than what expectations are.
Kristen Soltis Anderson and Cornell Belcher, thank you both. You're two people I always like to turn to when we want to talk a little numbers, analytics, and campaigns. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Chuck Toddcast from Meet the Press. Today's episode was produced by Justice Gilpin Green and Matt Rivera. John Reese is our executive producer. Our theme music composed by Spoke Media. You can catch Meet the Press daily on MSNBC every day at 1. Meet the Press Reports is on demand on Peacock. And The Big Show every Sunday morning. Thanks for listening, and until we upload again.